bottom of your cheek. Hit bottom of your cheek.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Berger Bayer. Bayer Bonamici. Boone. Boone Boquist. Bruin. Bruin Buckley. Burley. Butler. Butler Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Clem Cowan. Cowan Dallum. Dingfelder. Dingfelder Chris Edwards. Chris Edwards David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Flores Galizio. Galizio Gerard. Gelzer. Gelzer Gilliam. Gilliam Gilman. Gerard. Greenlick. Hannah. Holvey. Hunt. Jensen. Jensen Comp. Kotek. Krieger. Krieger Crummel. Crummel Lim. Lim McPherson. McPherson Maurer. Maurer Minnis. Minnis Morgan. Morgan Nathanson. Nelson. Nelson Nolan. Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Roblin. Roblin Rosenbaum. Schaffler. Schaffler Scott. Scott Shields. Greg Smith. Greg Smith Patty Smith. Patty Smith Thatcher. Thatcher Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Not answering. Bayer. Boone. Bruin. Clem. Cowan. Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. Galizio. Gelzer. Gilliam. Krieger. Crummel. McPherson. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nelson. Roblin. Schaffler. Scott. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Excused. Boquist. Cameron. Crummel. Excused for business of the House. Barnhart. David Edwards. Hunt. Nathanson.
Colleagues, we do have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and proceed. Upon
We were put back into propositions and motions. At this moment, I believe that President Greenlick, did you have a request?
I do, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to return to the order of courtesies.
Representative Greenlick asks for unanimous consent to return to the order of courtesies. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
I'd like to introduce you in the upper gallery Dr. Jean Marie Gase, who's one of my colleagues from OHSU, a fine researcher, and an obstetrician-gynecologist who's working hard to improve the safety of hospitals in our region. Dr. Gase, we welcome you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
It's good to have you with us. Please put up with the feedback. If you can't stand it, cover your ears. All right. So, Chair requests unanimous consent to temporarily return to the order of third reading of to advance to the third reading of House bills so that we can consider House Bill 3527A. Is there an objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 3527 relating to racing activity vehicles.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3527A. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you a great economic development bill with House Bill 3527A. It has to do with Brammo Motorsports in Ashland. That's a name you're going to hear a lot of in the next few years, and it's a company to pay attention to. The short story about it, the owner of the company is a man who made his fortune elsewhere, moved to Ashland to retire, but didn't find retirement suitable for him. He was a very, very energetic man, and he started as a hobby to build these vehicles, a replica of the Errol Adam racing car from Great Britain. And these are handmade vehicles. They're really quite extraordinary. And he rented out part of our science museum, actually, to work as his workshop to build this car by hand. And everyone who saw the car just found it to be astounding. And they kept saying, are you going to make more of these? These are incredible. Somehow, the Tonight Show host Jay Leno, who collects cars, got a hold of photos of what this vehicle was and decided he had to have one. So Mr. Leno bought one of these handcrafted racing vehicles. And from there, business started to kind of explode. And this company founded itself in Ashland, is already up to 60 employees paying living wage jobs and creating these remarkable vehicles. And what this bill before us today does, it allows for Brammo to register the Errol Adam racing vehicle as a special category of vehicle. Currently in statute, you can register a kit car or a replica car if you construct it yourself. What this is going to allow Brammo to do is to have those 60 very well-paid employees build these cars in the factory in Ashland. If you get a chance to visit this factory, you've got to come see it. These are handmade vehicles of the highest quality, and they're quite amazing. The profits from the Errol Adam are going to go to fund a line of other vehicles, including a four-seat electric car that I think is going to be revolutionary for our state and for the country, and an electric motorcycle as well that goes 65 miles per hour. It's designed like a 1940s motorcycle. It's quite fantastic. This is a company that's really growing. It's going to have a great impact on our state, creating jobs and creating products that are going to be very great for our state of Oregon. I'd like to thank Jack Evans of Department of Transportation for working closely with us to make sure we crafted a registration that fits this vehicle. Just to allay any fears, the Errol Adam, and I have photos if anybody wants to see the car, will not be driven on freeways. This allows people to buy the car, to register it as a racing vehicle, to drive it to a track if they want to take it to a track on a Saturday afternoon that's within 90 miles of their home and drive it back home, not on a freeway. It is a unique vehicle. It's a beautiful vehicle, and they're producing 1.5 per week now, and it's a growing industry for my district, and I would greatly appreciate your support of this bill to basically allow the registration of these cars in our state. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Buckley, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those with the opinion the bill should pass, vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Patty Smith, how do you vote? She votes aye. Representative Schaffler votes no. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Representative Jensen votes aye. House Bill 3527A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Chair requests unanimous consent to temporarily advance to the order of business of final reading, memorials, and resolutions. Is there an objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Clerk, read the first resolution.
H.J.R. 49 proposed an amendment to our constitution relating to granting crime victims remedy for a violation of constitutional rights.
The question now arises upon final reading and adoption of House Joint Resolution 49A. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There's a saying in the law, every right must have its remedy. In other words, rights don't mean much if you can't legally enforce them. In 1999, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, our state's Bill of Rights, was amended by the addition of Sections 42 and 43 to establish certain rights for victims of crimes. Section 42 provides the crime victim with several rights, including the right to be informed about critical stages of the prosecution of the defendant, the right to refuse an interview requested by the defendant, and the right to restitution from the defendant if convicted. But Section 42 does not provide any remedy for the victim who is denied these rights. Furthermore, subsection 2 of Section 42 provides that these rights cannot invalidate a ruling of a court or otherwise suspend any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceedings. House Joint Resolution 49 would amend Section 42 of Article 1 of the Constitution to grant crime victims the right to a remedy by due course of law. A victim's claim could be asserted in a mandamus proceeding or under other procedures enacted by the legislature. The resolution adds language carving these proceedings out from the ruling of a court and otherwise suspend limitations now found in Section 42. It also states that if no other person is determined to be the victim, the people of Oregon, represented by the prosecuting attorney, are considered the victims. It clearly states that in no event is the criminal defendant considered to be the victim. The statement of victims' rights and the express limitation that those rights cannot invalidate a ruling of the court nor otherwise suspend a criminal proceeding are now set out in our Constitution. The scholars who have considered the issue conclude that an amendment to the Constitution is necessary in order to give a remedy to victims. Therefore, your Judiciary Committee reported to you House Joint Resolution 49, which refers an amendment to Article 1, Section 42 to the people at the November 2008 general election. I urge an aye vote on H.J.R. 49.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative McPherson, do you wish to close? He does not. Those opinion the House Joint Resolution 49A should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Shields, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Representative Jensen votes aye. And Representative Burley? Representative Burley votes aye. House Joint Resolution 49A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next resolution.
H.J.R. 50, proposing amendment to Oregon Constitution related to granting crime victims mechanism for enforcing constitutional right regarding pretrial release of defendant.
Question now arises upon final reading and adoption of House Joint Resolution 50A. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As that great philosopher Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. You have before you House Joint Resolution 50, which would refer to the voters an amendment to Article 1, Section 43 of the Oregon Constitution, to provide a remedy for denial of victims' rights now provided in that section. It comes as a companion to House Joint Resolution 49, on which you just voted. In 1999, the voters approved the amendment that put Section 43 in the Constitution, in a separate measure from the one that put Section 42 into the Constitution. Section 43 granted victims the right to be reasonably protected from the criminal defendant and the right to have pretrial release decisions of the court based on the principle of reasonable protection of the victim, including denial of bail in certain cases. Sections 42 and 43 were voted on separately pursuant to that action in 1999 because of the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in the Armada case in 1998, which required separate votes on multiple changes to the Constitution. This requirement of separate votes is sometimes referred to as the single subject rule. Since sections 42 and 43 to Article 1 were voted on separately when they were first adopted, caution dictates that the amendments be voted on separately now. Therefore, I urge an aye vote on HJR 50 for the same reasons as I urged an aye vote on HJR 49.
Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I just wanted to call to your attention these two memorials.
To the resolution.
Colleagues, these two resolutions came out of a work group. It was the Attorney General's Office and Crime Victims United working together to get some consensus on these bills. These are both great bills, and this one I ask for I vote. Thank you.
Representative McPherson, do you wish to close? He does not. Those opinion that the resolution should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Dallum, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Kotek votes aye. Representative Crummell votes aye. House Joint Resolution 58, having received required majority, is declared adopted. Clerk will read the next memorial.
HGM 23, urging Congress to reauthorize state children's health insurance program.
Question now arises upon final reading and adoption of House Joint Memorial 23A. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good afternoon, colleagues. I urge your support of House Joint Memorial 23A. It comes out of the Health Care Committee with a unanimous do adopt recommendation. Congress recently demonstrated its commitment to the health of America's children by allowing up to $50 billion in new funds for reauthorization of the state children's health insurance program in recent congressional budget resolutions. SCHIP, or the State Children's Health Insurance Program, is the federal program that has allowed us to cover children at slightly higher incomes across this country to provide health insurance for them. It has been a very successful government program, and it is up for reauthorization. This memorial urges our state and our delegation to work with the administration and Congress to reauthorize the SCHIP program at the $50 billion that it's, has been requested. It also would provide a unique opportunity for Congress to strengthen SCHIP and Medicaid by providing new tools so that states can reach more uninsured children and ensure that they get the help they need. These tools may include eligibility options to cover pregnant women through SCHIP without relying on waivers, to cover kids of low-wage state employees or low-wage workers, period, and to provide SCHIP and Medicaid to those who are currently not covered. Congress also has the opportunity to provide new enrollment tools such as Express Lane option that would allow states to use financial information from other programs such as the school lunch program or the WIC program to enroll children. It would also have an opportunity to cut some red tape and reduce some of the paperwork that is involved with this program. Colleagues, we all know that when children have health insurance, they have access to health, better access to health care. They are healthier and succeed in life. They have more opportunities. And I urge your support for House Joint Memorial 23A to encourage Congress to do the right thing and reauthorize SCHIP at a substantial level. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Kotek, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those opinion that House Joint Memorial 23A should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Patty Smith votes aye, and Representative Greg Smith votes aye. House Joint Memorial 23A, having been received a constitutional majority, is declared adopted. Representative Callan, for what purpose do you rise?
Request to return to courtesies.
Representative Callan requests a return to courtesies. Is there any objection? Seeing none, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'd like to ask you to welcome some of the students from the Angel Job Corps Center who have just joined us in the gallery. Welcome.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Representing Clem, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. Speaker, I'd also like to return to the order of courtesies.
We are there right now. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'd like you to welcome my mother, Linda Clem, who's here and would be happy to furnish embarrassing stories about me at will.
Very good to have you. Further courtesies. Representative Bonamici. We are under propositions and motions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move the adoption of the committee report on House Bill 3086.
Representative Bonamici moves adoption of the committee report on House Bill 3086. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 3086, as it came out of committee, is a fair bill that revises the motor vehicle liability laws so that policies issued in Oregon provide liability coverage for each family member of the insured in an amount equal to the amount of liability coverage purchased by the insured. And the best way to explain this is to give you an example. Say, for example, you want to go to the beach this weekend with your family. You put your family in the car, your child invites a friend, you're driving to the beach, and for some reason you lose control of the car. Everyone in the car is injured, and they have some serious injuries. Can you collect up to the amount of liability insurance? Your child's friend can, but your own family cannot. And that's because of something called a family or household exclusion provision that's likely buried in the fine print in your insurance policy. Colleagues, this is not a fair way for us to do business in Oregon. We buy insurance to protect ourselves and to protect our families. When we purchase that insurance, we should be entitled to collect on it, to collect the damages that we suffer in an accident. Under current law, if you decide to purchase that insurance to protect you and your family, you are limited to an amount of $25,000. So, colleagues, if you or your kids have injuries beyond $25,000, you're out of luck. And that's because of this family exclusion that's buried in your insurance policy. The other thing that House Bill 3086 does as it passed out of committee is to address the same issue that we took up on this floor last week in House Bill 2908. And that was the family that got hit by an E-plate or by a school district bus, and they were limited even though they had purchased an umbrella policy. This bill also addresses that. We did address that issue in 2908, but this bill does two things. Colleagues, we hope that you don't have the kind of tragedy that does happen in these situations, but when it does, you should be entitled to collect on your insurance policy. This is a fair bill, it's good policy, and I urge your adoption of House Bill 3086, the committee report of House Bill 3086. Thank you.
Representative Girard,
Mr. Speaker, I move the minority report on House Bill 3086 be substituted for the committee report.
Representative Girard moves the minority report on House Bill 3086 be substituted for the committee report. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. I want to thank Representative Bonamici for kind of outlining the problem that we have in statute. The problem that we have in statute is that oftentimes family members are restricted to a cap of $25,000, and that comes out of your PIP insurance. The question between the minority report and the majority report is not addressing the current statute. Both will allow all economic damages. And for you, that I put a flyer on your desk, it's from John Powell and Associates, and it explains what was then the Dash 1 amendments that did not get incorporated into this bill. And on page 2 of that, in yellow underline, you'll see economic damages and non-economic damages. The difference between the majority report and the minority report is that simply the minority report will not allow pain and suffering or non-economic damages. For you that don't have your sheet there, economic damages by statute means objectively verified monetary losses, including but not limited to reasonable charges necessarily incurred for medical, hospital, nursing, rehabilitative services, and other health care services, burial and memorial expenses, loss of income, and past and future impairment of earning capacity, reasonable and necessary expenses incurred for substitute domestic services, recurring loss to an estate, damage to reputation that is economically verifiable, reasonable and necessarily incurred costs due to the loss and use of property, and reasonable costs incurred for the repair or the replacement of damaged property, whichever is less. Again, the difference between the majority report and the minority report is the minority report will not include pain and suffering. This was a compromise that was worked out by the insurance industry, and the problem they have with including pain and suffering is very simple. That will be that there is an assumption that there is a very high likelihood of collusion between the spouse, a lot of this is spouse, or the family member, and the driver. So, for example, you could have a drunk driver who is at a bar with his wife who is soused. They both get in the car. The drunk driver, the husband, let's say, crashes the car. The wife then would be entitled to sue not just for economic damages, but for pain and suffering as well. And this, there will be all kinds of examples that will be like that. And so I think it's very important that we pass the minority report to make this a good bill. Otherwise, we're asking for all kinds of legal problems. And I just don't think that you should be in the wrong and come out with more money than you started with. And that would be the problem with the majority report.
Further discussion of the motion to substitute the minority report for the committee report. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion on the minority report.
To the motion.
Thank you. First, I'd like to address the issue of collusion. Colleagues, we have before us something that's good policy. There will always be some people who try to take advantage. That happens. But that doesn't mean that we don't enact good policy just because there may be a few who try to take advantage. For example, there are people who forge checks. That doesn't mean we're going to tell the rest of the state that they can't use a checking account. There are people who cheat on take-home exams. Are we going to ban take-home exams because some people might take advantage? No, we can't do that. We have to look at what is good policy. There are fraud investigators and insurance companies. They can go after those few situations where there is collusion. So we shouldn't be making good policy decisions that will affect the rest of the state because a few people out there, in fact, I was told in California, it's less than 1 to 2% of all insurance claims have some sort of insurance fraud in the event that that comes up. Now to the issue of economic and non-economic damages. First of all, I want to make it perfectly clear that non-economic damages are incredibly difficult to prove. It's not necessarily a given. You can't just go into court and say, I want some pain and suffering. It's a pretty tough burden to prove those damages. but more importantly, on the reason why we should not be limiting in this minority report is because by capping non-economic damages, which is what the minority report seeks to do, we're discriminating against several groups of people, including, for example, stay-at-home parents. If you're a stay-at-home mom or stay-at-home dad, you don't have income. You can't go into court and prove lost income. Actual damages that you get, economic loss, you pay that back. You pay it to the hospital. You pay it to the doctors, burial expenses. That money's gone. If your life is so severely affected, there's no way that you can get compensation without non-economic damages. Children are another example. What if a child loses a limb? 2 or 3 years of his or her life. They can't recover lost wages. They're deemed too speculative for a child to prove. So they don't get anything under the minority report. The same thing as somebody who's retired. People who are, for example, in the golden years and they're on a retirement vacation and they have this type of tragic accident. They can't prove lost wages. They're retired. So they're stuck with nothing except the economic damages, which, as I explained, those get paid back. But that's not to compensate them for perhaps affecting the rest of their retirement. So for most people, any economic recovery simply is going to be turned over to medical providers. Thus, the bulk of economic recovery goes back to the providers of the insurance company. And so non-economic damages serve a very important function in compensating people who have been injured, and that's what this bill is about. And there's one more thing I want to point out on the minority report that's pretty important. This bill really deals with this family and household exclusion, but I looked at the language in the minority report, and it seeks to limit non-economic damages also for the insured. And so that kind of goes beyond what we talked about in committee and beyond the original bill. Line 15 of page 2 seeks to limit the non-economic damages for the insured. And if you're aware, voters in the state turned down a limit on non-economic damages at the ballot recently. So we shouldn't be extending what the bill intended to do by adopting the minority report. And I urge your no vote on the adoption of this report. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is it appropriate for me to speak to the minority report?
To the motion to substitute the minority report.
To the motion, then. Mr. Speaker, I think we should adopt this minority report. I hate insurance. I don't often understand insurance, but it's a necessary evil. My college roommate used to sell life insurance, and I would tell him, I'll buy twice as much if I don't have to listen to your pitch. This is not life insurance, so don't confuse this as an investment. In committee, we heard a lot of testimony about the fact that folks aren't getting what they paid for, as if there was some pot of money that they've been paying into. This is not an investment. This is car insurance. So we need to separate those two out in our thinking. You buy the coverage to protect you if you crash into someone. I have two daughters and a stepson. I believe that they love me. This bill could shatter that illusion because it would give them an opportunity to sue me. And I don't want to know if they're going to sue me or not. This family exclusion is a really, really important part of this. And I don't think we should open up the can of worms of those individuals in our car. They could be a hitchhiker or some neighbor, but most likely it's going to be members of our family. Why would we open this up for family members to sue family members? That makes no sense to me at all, and it's way beyond the limitations. What we have here is not necessarily a minority report that speaks, you know, diametrically against the bill. I think what we have in the minority report is a great compromise, and I hope you'll seriously consider it. The minority report already goes a long way toward giving you what you paid for. The $25,000 limit is still there. As representative from Sandy Am already mentioned, it provides for economic losses. It provides for medical reimbursement, for future medical, for loss of wages, for future loss of wages. Don't open this up to the awful can of worms called pain and suffering. In this case, it's going to open up a can of worms that I don't think we can get back under control. The representative mentioned that it's just a few cases. Well, I don't know that, and I don't even want it to happen in a few cases. Pain and suffering is a very gray area. We heard in testimony that because of medical technology, you know, you can, with an MRI, there's just very little room for any kind of deception in terms of an injury. Back injuries are almost impossible to prove or disprove. And for family members to start down the path of this tissue damage to their back and sue their father or their mother who was driving is just the wrong way to go. Let's don't open up that can of worms. Let's don't pit families against each other. Let's be reasonable and look at this bill as a way to correct a wrong, but not go too far. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
For the discussion of the motion to substitute, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion?
To the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will be voting against the motion to substitute the minority report for the bill. And it's not because I don't share concerns about the idea of family members suing family members. I don't think that's what this is about. I think that this is about family members being able to benefit from the protections that are available to them as family members of insured people. Take, for instance, several years ago when I was a stay-at-home mother taking care of four children under the age of five. Had I gone out in a car with my best friend and been severely injured and stuck at home, unable to complete my duties, I would have been eligible under her insurance benefit for reimbursement for the expenses of care for my children and my home that I could no longer provide, that couldn't be considered under economic damages because I did not receive a wage for them. However, if I received the same injuries in a car driven by my husband, that same level of protection would not be available to me, even though my family had helped to pay for the benefit that provided that level of protection. I think that this is an issue that is especially important for families that have a caregiver that is staying at home to care for children and other family members. Most often today, still, it is women that are doing that. And it was timely to me, I read on CNN that Salary.com recently did a report about if stay-at-home mothers were paid for the work that they did, their average salary would be about $138,095 per year. The costs to substitute the work that those women are doing are enormous and will not be available to them. They should be. Further, even women mothers who are working, who are coming home, average logging another 49 hours of dedicated work to keeping up their children and their families at home. Again, that is work that continues to need to be done that cannot be recovered through an economic damage. These families, these women, these men, when it's men that are doing this, should be protected by their family insurance policies. I don't think that it's about family members suing family members. It's about families being protected by an insurance premium that they are paying for in the event of a catastrophic loss. Losing the ability to provide family caregiving and homemaking activities is a catastrophic loss. All of that work must be done, whether or not that individual is there to do it, and you cannot recover those things as an economic loss because there are no wages. I will be voting against the minority report because I believe that it's very important that all Oregonians are able to benefit from the protections of their insurance policies and that we value the non-paid work that our family members do to support all of us, to support our children, and to support our households. Please join me in voting no.
To the motion, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Friends, I just wanted to get up and address a couple of issues. First of all, I very much agree with the representative from Corvallis and Philomath about the fact that this is not about families suing family members. And I wanted to address that, which was brought up by the representative from Oregon's Christmas Tree District. And the fact is that if you believe that that's what this is about, then both bills are about that. If you think that this is about families suing families, the Minority Report is also about that. I don't believe that it's about that. But if that's one of your concerns, then you have the same concern for both the Majority and the Minority Report. That's all I wanted. Thank you very much.
Representative Butler.
To the motion.
To the motion.
Thank you. Colleagues, this has been kind of a fun trip down memory lane as I've listened to the discussion, and particularly as we've talked about this particular House bill and the House bill committee report and the minority report. My father, in 1946, with two other men, established a business called Grigg Brothers and Butler Real Estate and Insurance. And it was the insurance part of that that was kind of the fun part that has kind of taken me down memory lane. And this discussion today and the discussion surrounding this particular bill. And I remember as a young boy of about 10 years old, Dad having to go out, and I'm going to make up these names. The names of the characters have been changed to protect those who are probably innocent. Probably innocent. I'm going to presume they were. But I recall that Dad received a call, and Paul had backed into Annie, and Annie was hurt, and Paul had bought a bunch of insurance, and his car insurance needed to be covering Annie. And I crawled in the old Woody with Dad, and we went out to Paul and Annie's farm. And I remember Dad explaining to Paul and Annie that a husband couldn't run over a wife and get full insurance coverage just because they had bought the insurance on the car. And I don't know that it applies to this particular situation or not, but I remember Annie was in awful tough shape when we arrived, but Dad was also a lay minister, and so he visited with them and talked to them about their marriage and some of their other kinds of family issues that Paul and Annie had. And Annie was looking pretty good by the time we left. And I'll never forget that lesson that Dad saying to Paul, you can't run over your wife and collect all of this insurance. You're just not going to be able to do that, and your wife is just going to have to get up and go back and take care of the kinds of things that she was taking care of. I think there was a house full of a dozen or two dozen kids. I can't remember. It seemed like every time Paul and Annie went out and mowed the lawn, they found another one anyway. So this has been wonderful to listen to this discussion. I remember now why it was that Dad explained that issue to me at the time, and I think that it still applies today. And so far as I know, Paul and Annie stayed together for a long, long time, and she lived to be a very healthy, I remember her passing away a number of years later, and they never did collect on that insurance. So down memory lane. Thank you very much.
Further discussion of the motion? Seeing none, Representative Girard, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, this really is a fairly simple comparison. Both will address the problem that was stated by statute that we are currently limited to $25,000 per family for a family member, $50,000 for an aggregate. One will allow economic damages, the minority report. The majority report will allow pain and suffering. By allowing pain and suffering, we open Pandora's box to a couple different things. One, just a huge number of lawsuits. Number two, which wasn't brought up before, is that we're going to open up a large financial responsibility to the insurance companies, which obviously will mean higher insurance rates. So if you're truly looking out for consumers, the vast number of consumers won't benefit by allowing pain and suffering. It's only going to be the very, very small number, and also the attorneys that try the case. So once again, economic damage has a pretty wide definition, and I would encourage you to vote for the minority report and think about, I'm going to give you two examples. One, again, a guy and his wife go to a bar. Both of them get plastered. He gets in the car and drives, plows into a pole. His wife gets seriously hurt. They get all the economic damages. Then they sue for pain and suffering for her. They get a nice award. They go and live happily ever after in Tahiti. The second example would be a guy that was at fault, drives off the road, hits a telephone pole. His wife's in a vegetative state. On behalf of the wife sues him for pain and suffering. She wins the major lawsuit. He pulls the plug, and then he goes off and lives in Tahiti happily ever after. That's not collusion. That's the sort of cases we're opening up here in Pandora's box. So please vote for the minority report. It'd be nice if we could vote for something that had something to do with policy and not party lines. I really, really would encourage you to vote for the minority report. Thank you.
Those are the opinion that the minority report on House Bill 3086 should be substituted for the committee report. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. The motion to substitute minority report from the committee report on House Bill 3086, having not received the required majority, is declared failed. Is there further discussion on adoption of the committee report? Seeing none, Representative Bonamici, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I want to tell you about Mrs. Ada Valenti. She came to our committee and talked about what happened to her. And I hope this doesn't happen to you or any of your constituents. Mrs. Valenti and her husband took her son and her grandsons on a trip to Disneyland. They were driving down to California on I-5 and the car rolled over. Her grandson's friend was killed. She and her son and one of the grandsons were all severely injured. She was still recovering from the tragedy. Her family purchased a policy with $100,000 per person in liability coverage, and they thought they would be protected. The insurance company paid the $100,000 to the family of the grandson's deceased friend, but for each person in the family, they were entitled to their $25,000 because of the family exclusion that was buried in their policy. And Ms. Tasha Mowry, who came and talked to us in the committee, she and her boyfriend were driving up near Warm Springs. Her boyfriend was driving and he lost control of the car. She was pregnant, lost the child. She still has more than $45,000 of unpaid medical bills because her bills were so high, and she was limited, even though she had a $100,000 policy, she was limited to the $25,000. The Idaho Supreme Court addressed the arbitrariness of this type of clause when a family's riding in a car. And the father's driving and he loses control of the car. What happens? The family exclusion clause defeats coverage for the members in the car, no matter how seriously they're injured, while their friends or relatives in the same car can recover. Now, here's what happens. The father's driving, but then they pull over, and the son, who's home from college, he starts driving, and all of a sudden they have coverage again. Well, then they stop at a rest stop, and the mother and sister take over, and they start driving, and all of a sudden they lose coverage again. And if the family friend slips behind the wheel, well, then the coverage reappears. If a neighbor next door is driving behind, with children from each family intermingled in the cars are both involved in the collision, only the children or spouses who are not in a car with their family will be compensated. Does that make sense? Consider these issues. Consumers buy auto insurance coverage primarily to protect themselves and their family members. The passenger who's likely to be injured in your car is most likely to be a family member. By inserting the family or household exclusion, the auto insurance industry is excluding from benefits the entire class of persons the auto insurance consumers most sought to protect. And finally, this is important. Colleagues, this is not a risk-based exclusion. There's risk-based exclusions. For example, people who ride ATVs or motorcycles. It might be a different situation because it's an exclusion based on risk. This is an exclusion that's based on a class of victims, not the drivers. And that, colleagues, is not good policy. The insertion of family household car exclusions into coverage defeats the primary purpose for which most insureds purchase auto insurance. Insureds buying high limits out of responsibility for and protection of their families often find the coverage paid is illusory or limited to statutory minimum. Family exclusions ultimately deprive innocent injured family victims of adequate compensation for which they planned, paid, and reasonably expected. Colleagues, I urge the adoption of the committee report on House Bill 3086. Thank you.
Those of the opinion that the committee report should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And I'll try that again. Those of the opinion the committee report should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem votes aye. Representative Richardson votes no. House Bill 3086, the motion to adopt the committee report, has received the required majority and is adopted. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that House Bill 3086 be read third time for final consideration immediately. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair requests unanimous consent to temporarily advance the order of business of third reading of House bills. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 3086 relating to motor vehicle liability insurance.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of House Bill 3086. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill. Colleagues, I'll summarize what House Bill 3086 does. Under House Bill 3086, you won't have an enforceable family or household exclusion in your policy, and that means that if you purchase insurance to protect your family will be protected. It also addresses the e-vehicle issue that we had in House Bill 2908 last week, that if you are legally entitled to recover the amount that your policy gives you, the fact that you're hit by an e-vehicle will not affect that coverage. Colleagues, this is good public policy, and as we talked about before, this is not about family members suing family members. way back when, historically, when there was a family immunity before insurance companies, that might have been the policy then. But frankly, family members won't need to sue family members under this bill when the insurance company pays what's rightfully owed. And the collusion, as I addressed before, that's something that can be addressed outside of this bill by investigators. This is good public policy. It allows family members who are injured to recover if they're in an accident in a car driven by someone in their family. And I want to just share with you from Mrs. Valenti's testimony when she came to tell us about the very tragic situation that happened with her. She said, "The biggest fear that any buyer of insurance has is that the coverage will not be there when needed. That certainly was the case for us. Please make sure that other Oregon families will not be put in this situation. Please pass House Bill 3086. Thank you for your consideration, and Mr. Speaker, I respectfully request a call of the House."
Representative Bonamici asks for a call of the House. She's joined by Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Greenlick, Representative Riley, Representative Shields, and Representative Olson. The doorkeepers bar the door. Sergeant Arms attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barker Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Bonamici.
Here.
Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Burley Butler. Cameron. Cannon. Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Jensen Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Nolan Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Scott Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Dingfelder, Jensen, Nolan, Scott, excuse, not subject to the call, two, Boquist, Cameron,
all members are present. Those of the opinion that House Bill 3086 should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll. Open the voting system. Representative Greg Smith, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Thatcher votes aye. Representative Wisnet votes no. House Bill 3086, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. First reading of House Bills. Second reading of House Bills.
House Bill 27 relating to fees charged by Employment Relations Board of Appropriate Amendment declared an emergency. House Bill 2243 relating to agencies. House Bill 2758 relating to recreational vehicles. House Bill 2783 relating to termination of workers' compensation coverage. House Bill 3120 relating to marriage forms issued by County Clerk. House Bill 3183 relating to employees of educational institutions. House Bill 3481 relating to temporary declared an emergency. House Bill 3490 relating to proof of loss.
Bill's read a second time or passed the third reading? Consent calendar. Third reading of House bills. Final reading of memorials and resolutions. Bills, reports, and other business line on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 58 relating to arbitrators available through state cancellation service. Senate Bill 104 relating to underground storage tanks. Senate Bill 473 relating to crime. Senate Bill 1034 relating to nursing assistance certificate fees.
Bills read first time or passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 202 relating to farm labor contractor duty. Senate Bill 203 relating to farm labor contractor. Senate Bill 265 relating to reporting to the Department of Human Services regarding psychiatric treatment methods. Senate Bill 322 relating to judgment. Senate Bill 380 relating to school employees and declaring emergency. Senate Bill 403 relating to meal periods for tipped employees. Senate Bill 417 related to boundary commissions and appropriated money. Senate Bill 516 related to sanitary districts. Senate Bill 553 relating to sentencing guidelines. Senate Bill 615 relating to boundary changes within metropolitan service districts. Senate Bill 773 relating to conflicts between provisions applicable to metropolitan service districts.
Bills read second time or passed the third reading? Third reading of Senate bills. Clerk, read the bill.
Senate Bill 105 relating to oil spills and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 105B. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, good afternoon. Senate Bill 105B is a very good bill. It comes at you from your House Committee on the Energy and Environment with five yes votes, no votes, two excused. This bill increases DEQ's fees assessed on cargo, passenger, and dredging vessels and onshore and offshore facilities to support their programs related to oil spills. As you may know, DEQ reviews spill prevention and response plans, participates in response drills, works with federal, local, and other state governments to ensure a quick and coordinated response to marine spills. This program is funded by fees from vessels and barges that transport large quantities of petroleum and by large facilities that transfer petroleum by pipeline over water. Fees for the program were last increased in 2001. This proposed increase will help the department maintain three positions for this program. It's supported by the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. We did not hear any opposition testimony in committee, and I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett asked for a call of the House. He is joined by Representative Richardson, Representative Hanna, Representative Nelson, Representative Scott, Representative Dallum. Dorkey will draw the doors. Sergeant Arms would attend, and clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Berger-Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Burley Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Dingfelder Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Flores Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Rosenbaum Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnett, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Burley, Dingfelder, Flores, Rosenbaum, excuse, not subject to the call, Boquist, Cameron.
Representative Wisnett, for what purpose do you rise?
Speaker.
All are present. Further discussion? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this bill increases greatly the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality fees. If you'll look at the information provided in your file, the least of those fee increases is 31%. The most of those fee increases is 138%. And colleagues, I'd like to point out, this isn't just an annual fee increase. This isn't a one-time fee increase. Many of these fee increases, if you will look closely, are per trip, per trip, per trip. This isn't just a one-time deal. This can be per day or per trip. This is excessive. If you would take the 2001 period forward and just average in a 3% fee increase, these fees would be increased somewhere just under 20%. Colleagues, we need to be very careful about these fee increases and how much we're raising them. I'd urge your no vote.
Colleagues, we will stand at ease under the call for the purpose of using restrooms in the Speaker's office. Further discussion, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question of the carrier. I wonder if
question of the carrier. Does Kerry yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. In my bill file here, I don't have an SMS from Ways and Means. So am I to assume correctly that this bill did not go to Ways and Means?
One minute, Representative, and I'll make sure that I get you as accurate an answer as possible.
Yeah, we're still under the call.
Thank you for your question, Representative. This fee increase was anticipated by the governor's budget, and therefore it did not go to Ways and Means.
Further question, Mr. Speaker?
Further question of the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I do.
The carrier yields.
So is it now, is there, I want to make sure I phrase this correctly, is there a spending limitation within the agency budget to include the spending that's in this bill?
Thank you, Representative. I am told by the committee chair that she believes there is a limitation, but we don't have somebody from LFO here, and I cannot give you a 100% definite answer to that question.
Further question, Mr. Speaker?
Additional question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
Carrier yields.
Thank you, Representative. So this is a fee bill that has a spending limitation attached to it of well over $50,000. But the Ways and Means Committee has never seen this bill and has never looked at the fee increase to see if it's substantiated or not, and has never seen the spending limitation that goes with this, correct?
Representative, my understanding is that the Ways and Means Committee, as it reviews the department's budget, will be looking at this, looking at their expenditures and proceeding accordingly.
I have a question of the Majority Leader. I wonder if he'll yield.
Question of the Majority Leader. Does the Majority Leader yield to a question?
I do.
He yields.
Thank you, Representative. So my question is, Do we now have a new rule in the legislature and in the legislative body that any bill, whether it has a over $50,000 amount or not, but as long as it's in the governor's recommended budget, then it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means?
I do not believe that is the rule, no.
Further question of the Majority Leader, Mr. Speaker?
Additional question. Does the Majority Leader yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. So if that's not in the rule and it's not a rule, is it now fair to say that that will be the practice of this body? Is it anything that is in the governor's recommended budget? Then it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means, and it can just come directly to the floor?
I believe, and actually the LFO analyst, I believe, is on the way to aid my good friend from the center of Portland in addressing these questions. But the as I'm looking at the fiscal on this, because it is other funds, and the issue is, are there general funds involved here? I am reading this correctly. It is completely other funds. And so I believe that has been the standard that's been utilized this session and in the past. If it's fees generating other funds, that's a very different situation. If this were $250,000 of general funds, it would definitely go to Ways and Means. As actually we illustrated in a bill earlier today, when the fiscal came back, it unexpectedly showed a $100,000 general fund fiscal on another bill. That bill, you'll recall earlier today, was referred from this floor to Ways and Means.
Further question of the Majority Leader, Mr. Speaker?
Additional question, do you yield?
If these are Ways and Means questions, I'd encourage you to question the Chair of Ways and Means.
Okay. May I ask a question of the Co-Chair of Ways and Means, please?
Question of Representative Nolan, do you yield?
Yes, thank you.
He does yield.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate you yielding to my question. Within the DEQ budget, is there a proposed spending limitation that includes the amount of money that's in this bill that we currently have under consideration, Senate Bill 105?
Thank you, Representative. Both the governor's and co-chair's recommended budget for this agency would include expenditure of funds that would be raised by this fee. But that bill has not been work sessioned in either the subcommittee or the full committee of Ways and Means. If this bill passes, then it will automatically be incorporated into the budget. If it doesn't pass, then it would need to go through Ways and Means so that we can coordinate both the fee and the expenditure.
Further question of the co-chair?
Additional question, do you yield?
Sure.
Thank you.
She does.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Representative. Are you seeing by any chance any kind of inconsistency in how we're dealing with bills, fee bills that just come to the floor versus going to Ways and Means first, or bills, fee bills that don't come to the floor first and go to Ways and Means first? Are you seeing any kind of an inconsistency in the practice?
Thank you, Representative. I don't see any inconsistency in the objective we're trying to accomplish, which is that the expenditure bills are coordinated with the revenue on which they depend. That can happen a couple of different ways, and that has been true not only in this session, but it's been true for several sessions. What we try to do is make sure that before we approve expenditure of funds, that we also make sure that the revenues are in place. We can do that either by moving the two bills simultaneously, which we sometimes do, or by coordinating the work that happens in Ways and Means on the expenditure limitation side with the work done in a policy committee, such as this is doing, or coordinating with the revenue committees to make sure that if the revenue is being raised through a bill that comes there, that we coordinate with them to make sure we're not spending, not approving expenditure of funds that have not yet been approved.
Thank you. I have a further question to the co-chair, Mr. Speaker.
Additional question. Does the co-chair yield?
Sure.
She does.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Representative. You mentioned earlier that this bill was anticipated by the governor's recommended budget and that it was also in the co-chair's recommended budget. Can you point me to where in the co-chair's, where in the detail of the co-chair's budget I will find this? Because I didn't see it there earlier, and that may be just my own oversight. So I wonder if you could tell me where I would find that detail.
Thank you, good representative. It's in the material that backs up the DEQ agency budget.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Well, colleagues, I see some inconsistencies here, and I thought about asking the speaker a question because I have a bill that had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that has a zero fiscal impact on the general fund or other funds or any other funds. And yet it had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means coming out of the Speaker's office. So that bill is now down in Ways and Means. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to get that bill out. But, of course, it may have had the subsequent referral so that it could just be sent there to die. And I understand the game. I've been here long enough, and I understand how the game is played. What I have an objection to, and I think we've had this conversation before on this floor, is that, well, it's in the governor's recommended budget. And if that's the case, Mr. Speaker, then tell the co-chairs, just bring the governor's budget out here. Let's pass the damn thing and go home. We're done. We don't need to screw around with anything else. It's finished.
Representative, you need to keep your comments germane to the contents of this measure.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
You're welcome.
So the contents of this bill are that it raises fees, as was noted earlier, by anywhere from 30 to 140%. This has not been seen by the Ways and Means Committee. It's not been added into the expenditure limitation except in the co-chair's budget. I would argue that this bill has not really had the kind of scrutiny that a bill should have. I think that we do have an inconsistency in how we're dealing with bills. I think there has been in the past, if a bill has over a $50,000 expenditure impact, then it would go to Ways and Means so that it could move tandemly with their budget or at least be included in the work session of the budget. And that's not the case here. So what we're going to do, because I assume that y'all are going to vote for this. I'm not going to vote for this. But I assume that y'all are going to vote for it. And so what's going to happen is that you're going to pass this fee bill. You're going to allow the department to raise the fees. And then there's also a spending limitation in here, but it's not part of their budget. And then, well, because their budget hasn't been work sessioned yet, it's going to then include this in their departmental budget. I think it's kind of putting the cart before the horse. But the thing that bothers me the most is the fact that we have such inconsistencies. When a bill has an impact such as this bill does, Mr. Speaker, of $250,000, thereabouts, and it doesn't go to the Ways and Means Committee to be considered as part of the rest of the agency budget, but there are other bills that have little or no impact, but of course they do get sent to Ways and Means to be considered as part of the budget. I think there is an inconsistency there. And I believe that in the past, when a bill had an impact, whether it was general fund or other funds or federal funds or any kind of funds, it didn't matter. It was sent to Ways and Means. Now, I may be wrong, and if somebody wants to correct me on that, they certainly may. But I think that this bill should have been sent to the Ways and Means Committee so that the appropriate subcommittee there could have looked at this in conjunction with the budget and how this is going to fit in and how the fee increase is going to fit in, as opposed to just coming on out to the floor and then we'll fit it in later. I object to the fact that we have that inconsistency. I object to the way this bill is structured and the way this bill has been handled, and therefore I'm going to vote no. And colleagues, I would encourage you to vote no, but I'm sure that y'all are not going to do that, but at least you'll know why this no vote is up on the board.
Further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Maybe this is because it's after 5, because you can see my speech. I am rising in support of this bill. This takes me back to when I first started down and here, working here as a legislative assistant, and actually the second session I worked here in 1991. The Coastal Caucus, made up of the 8 coastal members, worked hard, and this was right around the time of the Exxon Valdez spill. They worked hard to meet the needs of the coastal communities, the fisheries, the ocean, and to protect our fisheries and our oceans and our coastal communities. Our biggest fear was another tanker disaster. The tankers going by our coast were single-hulled at the time. We got the motion started to now they are double-hulled. And other issues were discussed. The biggest deal was putting a fee on these vessels, any vessels, including even fishing vessels, and it started out as innocently as that. When it came obvious that the fee on the vessel was per trip, it added up quite quickly for the smaller fishing vessels. And so there was much discussion about how that should be done. Fast forward to the future, and here we have, right now we're talking about, these are mostly tankers, and well, these are not talking about fishing vessels right now, but cargo and passenger vessels. An oil spill from something like that could be quite large. They're asking for a $22 increase in this fee, and I just did the math on this, and I'm not a mathematician, but these fees will go from, you know, they raise an additional $22 to $58 for the smaller vessels. You get up to a self-propelled tank over 300 gross tons, it's $364. That's not a lot of money to help the DEQ, help them with a spill prevention plan and manage it. Offshore and onshore facilities are up by $1,400. But in any case, they need that because the spills cost hundreds of thousands, if not into the millions of dollars, to clean up. This is a prevention issue. We continually ask our agencies to take on an increasingly large workload. I'm having trouble talking here. And I'm concerned that with this additional workload and these potential, this is a small price to pay. I'll try to sum this up. Small price to pay for a big job and a big risk saver that they provide for us. This fee will recover the costs of the oil spill prevention programs and allow us to continue our fisheries and continue our coastal communities, tourism programs for all of you who come to the beach. And hopefully you'll vote for this bill. It really is a small price to pay. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Nolan. Further discussion, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There's been several, as chair of the Energy and Environment Committee, that heard this bill, and also sitting on the Ways and Means Committee. I get the benefit of looking at both the DEQ's budget and then hearing the testimony on this bill. And I just would like to read for the record some of the support that we heard in our committee. We heard no opposition to this bill. There was extensive work with the stakeholders that was done during the interim. And I have a letter here from the Columbia River steamship operators that pay the vessel fees enumerated in Senate Bill 105. The Columbia River Steamship Operators Association worked extensively with DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, during the interim on this fee bill, and that's in reference to Senate Bill 105. We found DEQ to be very receptive to our proposed modifications to fee amounts and suggestions of types of vessels covered. This Columbia River Steamship Operators urges your support of Senate Bill 105 in its present form. And I also want to note that fishing vessels are not included. If you look in your SMSA, they are not included as the type of vessel that would have to pay this fee. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Minnis.
Question to the Speaker. Does the Speaker yield?
Speaker does not yield.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to the bill.
To the bill.
It is under the Speaker's purview to not yield to a question, but I had hoped, Mr. Speaker, you would be willing to clarify for this body what your policy is as the Speaker of the House as to the referrals of the bills. And since there seems to be an ongoing confusion...
Representative Minnis?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Just to remind all members of the body, in speaking, the member must confine the discussion to the question under debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think that this issue was raised earlier. I was addressing the point the other member was raised, and you allowed him to have his leeway, and so I presumed that I could have the same way. However, if you object to the subject matter, that is your right as the Speaker of the House, and I will submit myself to your discretion. Ladies and gentlemen, this bill should have gone to Ways and Means, and I would submit to you, had we done this last session, you would have been all over this. If the Speaker does not want to clarify for this body what his policy is about which bills are referred or not, that is his right. But this bill should have been referred to Ways and Means to be considered alongside of the budget. So with that, Mr. Speaker, I'll have a seat. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Cannon, do you wish to close?
Thank you briefly. I appreciate, colleagues, all the attention this bill has received. I want to point out just a couple of things. One is to thank my colleague from the Upper Left Coast for reminding us what this is really about, which is helping the state prepare for the possibility of oil spills that would potentially cripple our economy or portions of it, our ecologies, in some of the most sensitive areas of the state. I also want to remind, speaking to the fiscal aspects, members, that this is all other funds, and that we heard a little about scrutiny and the scrutiny this would undergo through Ways and Means process. Well, the kind of scrutiny this has received over the past year has been stakeholders, the people who will pay these fees, sitting around a table with DEQ and agreeing that this is a necessary fee increase in order for DEQ to continue doing the work that they're doing. We heard no opposition. Stakeholders, those who pay the fees, are in support or at least not opposed. And I urge your I vote. Thank you.
Representative Richardson, for what purpose do you rise?
I request an oral roll call vote.
Representative Richardson asked for an oral roll call, and he is joined in that request by Representative Scott, Representative Flores, Representative Thatcher, Representative Clem, and Representative Crummell. Those who are of the opinion that Senate Bill 105B should pass will vote aye when called upon. Those opposed will vote no when called upon. And the clerk will call the roll in alphabetical order.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Butler. Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Cowan. Dallum. Dingfelder. Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Galizio. Garrard. Gelzer. Gilliam. Gilman. Gerard. Greenlick. Hannah. Holvey. Hunt. Jensen. Comp. Kotek. Krieger. Crummel. Lim. McPherson. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nathanson. Nelson. Nolan. Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Roblin. Rosenbaum. Schaffler. Scott. Shields. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Voting no. Burley. Butler. Dallum. Garrard. Gilliam. Gilman. Gerard. Hannah. Krieger. Crummel. Lim. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nelson. Olson. Richardson. Schaffler. Scott. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Wisnet. Excused. Two. Boquist. Cameron. Correction, voting no, Flores.
The vote is 34 yea, 24 nay. The bill, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill.
Senate Bill 190, relating to testing for disease at a request of employee of Department of Corrections and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 190. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, Senate Bill 190 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, where it passed out unanimously. This bill allows any employee of the Department of Corrections to request a test of bodily fluids when that employee comes into contact with the bodily fluids of another person while in the performance of their duties. Of particular concern for corrections employees are HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. Often inmates will deliberately throw their bodily fluids, the polite term there, at corrections employees, which is an obvious health risk to those employees. Senate Bill 190 has minimal fiscal impact. It is a good bill, and it deserves your aye vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Barker, do you wish to close? He does not. Those opinion bill should pass. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Krieger votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? He votes aye. Senate Bill 190, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 260, relating to protective proceedings.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 260. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senate Bill 260 comes to you from the House Committee on Judiciary. This bill is about very vulnerable individuals and how we can protect their rights to life-sustaining treatment, including feeding and hydration. Currently, under current statute, individuals that have guardians are not presumed to have consented or desired continuation of artificial hydration and nutrition. One reading of the statutes would suggest that a guardian has the authority to consent to withdrawing or withdrawal of tube feeding at any point in the protected person's life for any reason whatsoever, and that they can do that with immunity from civil or criminal liability. The reasons for that could include everything from concerns about the person's health to the belief that it's no longer convenient to care for that individual. The reading also suggests that the healthcare provider who orders the withholding and withdrawal ensures similar protection from liability. This bill is about closing that important loophole and allowing individuals who cannot speak for themselves to have the same rights that the rest of us do. During the past year, the Oregon Advocacy Center, which is the statewide federally mandated group that provides legal services for individuals with disabilities, was called to intervene in three cases in which a guardian had given consent to remove tube feeding from a protected person who had not been medically determined to have a terminal condition. These are the calls that prompted the Oregon Advocacy Center to question the responsibility and powers of guardians in this case. I'd like to give you an example. A middle-aged man with severe cerebral palsy, who I will call Tom, had lived in a group home for many years. His digestive system began to work improperly, and he was transferred to a local hospital for treatment. There, his guardian and doctor agreed that he should be removed from his feeding tube and placed in hospice so that he could prepare to die. Staff from the group home, who has known Tom for a very long time, objected and made a complaint to the Oregon Advocacy Center, pointing out that he did not have a terminal condition and that there was no reason why his life was in jeopardy as long as he continued to have access to food and water. OAC's investigation revealed that hospital staff had not, in fact, determined that Tom was in a terminal condition. Tom was returned from hospice to the hospital for additional treatment and testing to assure and protect him from having his life prematurely ended. Senate Bill 260 will close a loophole in our law that allows court-appointed guardians like Tom's to consent to the withholding or withdrawing of tube feeding at any time and under any conditions without any civil or criminal liability. Senate Bill 260 clarifies that a guardian, like any other appointed health care representative in Oregon, may stop tube feeding only if two doctors have confirmed that the affected person meets one of four conditions. One, she has a terminal condition, or she is permanently unconscious, or she would suffer permanent and severe pain with no medical benefit, or she is in the final stage of a progressive illness that will be fatal. Oregon law already provides this protection to other individuals. People with severe disabilities that have guardians appointed to their care should expect that same level of protection. Oregon law provides that every person is presumed to have consented to tube feeding that is necessary to sustain his life unless he has clearly stated otherwise. Senate Bill 260 will assure that people with guardians have this protection as well. Your vote today in support of Senate Bill 260 will protect the lives of individuals like Tom who are extremely vulnerable because of their disabilities, and it will affirm that we in Oregon honor the value and dignity of every life. I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Gelser, do you wish to close?
I do not. Thank you.
Those of opinion that Senate Bill 260 should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Hunt votes aye. Representative Nathanson votes aye. Representative Butler votes no. Representative Burley votes aye. Representative Thatcher votes no. Representative Thatcher votes no. Senate Bill 260, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 408, relating to termination of parental rights.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 408A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Senate Bill 408 came to you from the Judiciary Committee by unanimous vote. Senate Bill 408 is one of nine bills that were the result of a sensitive review committee and a work group that worked on these issues for the last 14 months. I might add that all nine bills passed out of the Senate with unanimous vote. I hope we can do the same here. I believe it might be of some value if I describe the process that led up to the package of dependency bills. During the last legislative session in the Judiciary Committee, we had a bill that we were trying to get information on, but because of confidentiality, we were not able to get the information we needed. We found that there was a provision in law for a sensitive review committee, and although it had been in place, it had never been used before. And Dr. Goldberg, when asked to convene a sensitive review committee, was able to do that for us. The members of that sensitive review committee were Representative Flores, Representative Richardson, Representative Schaffler, Acosta, Representative Dr. Goldberg himself, Ramona Foley, Mickey Cerise, Nancy Miller, and several staff from Lincoln County. I was asked today to explain what Representative Schaffer was doing on the work group committee. I was looking for someone with a B personality and who was unopinionated. The case involved 3,500 pages. Now, obviously, we never get through that. So Joe O'Leary, who was our staff attorney at the time, reduced that down to 310 pages. We had three meetings of 3 to 4 hours going through that. 38 questions were asked of DHS, and were taken into consideration of the things you're going to hear on the series of bills. But as a result of that particular work group, that family, in fact, was reunited, and the grandmother was able to see her granddaughter for the first time in 3 years. Good work. Some of the outcomes was these nine of the work group, nine bills, administrative rule changes, DHS policy changes, training for caseworkers, training for attorneys that was provided by the state bar, increased compensation for attorneys as represented, being asked for, representation for DH caseworkers, that there would be better representation for the parents and the children, and the quality of representation we hope will also improve. Some of the people that took part in this and who we solicited information were people from the governor's office, Joe O'Leary. The Attorney General, Hardy Myers, was extremely helpful in information, and some of his ideas from his work group or task force were worked into the plan. The Juvenile Rights Project, the Justice System, the Appellate Court, Circuit Court, and the Supreme Court, CASA, Citizens Review Board, Public Defender's Office, District Attorneys, House, and Senate. And I really believe that it was one of the greatest cooperative efforts I've seen between the different branches of government, legislative, judicial, and the governor. Specifically to Senate Bill 408, one of the grounds for termination of parental rights is that a child has been in substitute care for 15 of the last 12 months. The Department of Human Resources must develop a permanency plan for every child under the jurisdiction of the court on a dependency matter. This plan may involve steps to reunify the child with his or her family, or it may take steps to terminate parental rights. and move towards an adoption. The court reviews these plans every 6 months. In between hearings, the department may decide that the reunification is not possible and start the process for parental termination and adoption. This can and does result in confusion for the parents and children with the court-approved plan for reunification and DHS moving towards adoption, just the opposite direction. Senate Bill 408 prohibits the Department of Human Services from filing a petition to terminate parental rights to his or her child only if the court has previously approved a permanency plan for the child. This bill clarifies that the measure applies to all sections of the Dependency Code when termination rights are at risk. Presently, as I've said, you have two things, moving towards termination and also the people at the same time, the parents, thinking that there's a plan for reunification taking place, only come to find out the agency is going the other way. I hope you'll support this bill. It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
Representative Shuffler.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I won't be as long on the rest of the bills, but on this one I'm going to take a little time. Representative Krieger and I sat next to one another last year on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, and Dr. Goldberg, I believe, wanted a Democrat on this committee, and Representative Krieger picked me, and I'm eternally grateful for that because it has introduced me to the area of the law, family law, that isn't always the most pleasant area, but is very important and vital in our decision-making process here. Representative Richardson and Representative Flores were also very helpful on this censor review committee. I would also like to thank Dr. Goldberg, obviously, Ramona Foley, Mickey Cerise, Nancy Miller, also Joe O'Leary, who's now at the governor's office, Bill Taylor, Judiciary Committee Administrator, Mara Gross, and Senator Brown's office, Senator Brown herself, and Senator Cruz, who this morphed into that group, and also Justice David Brewer, who has a juvenile dependency appellate court process going on, reviewing that process well, going on right now, and I think next session we'll be hearing more about that. This bill, as my friend from Gold Beach has pointed out, won't allow the DHS to file a petition to terminate parental rights unless they have a permanency plan for these children. Currently, we can terminate the rights, I think rightfully so, obviously. We need to be batting 1,000 when we do that to protect the extended family of parents and obviously the health, safety, health, and welfare of every child in the state, especially these children in so much need of protection. But if we do that, we have to have a plan so they're not stuck out there in foster care limbo land, just kind of floating at times from foster care to foster care home or facility. So it's a good bill. I urge your vote. Thank you very much.
Further discussion, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, I know it's late in the day, and I appreciate your attention to this bill and the next three bills. I want to thank publicly the good representative from Southwestern Oregon and the good representative from Happy Valley for working on these package of bills. One of the highest responsibilities we have as legislators, I believe, is to make sure that our child welfare system is really working, especially for our children in foster care, because research has shown us that the longer a child stays in foster care, unfortunately, the worse their outcomes. These bills are really important, and I want to thank my colleagues for working on these, and I hope you support all of them. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I just want to rise and congratulate Representative Krieger. This agency has had many difficulties in this branch in particular, having to do with how to best care for our kids that are in foster care. I want to thank Representative Krieger for all his efforts. He brought this group together, and under our direction, he did a phenomenal job. They went in areas that have always been a little bit beyond our reach, and he found an obscure piece of statute and was able to take advantage of that, and I think has brought some great changes that will help our kids in the long run. So I want to publicly thank him, Senator Kate Brown, for working with him in this effort, and bringing together, I think, which will be some good, long overdue changes. In fact, my staff, when I was speaker, actually spent a good deal of time just dealing with families and children, and there seemed at some times to be no good solution. So hopefully as a result of the efforts that have been put forward on this bill, we'll see some good changes done at the department. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
Just briefly, Madam Speaker. House Bill 408 brings some clarity and direction for both the families, the children, and for DHS. It's a good bill. You can't be going towards termination at the same time that you're trying to reunite families, and they need to have some certainty, and this will help it make it happen. So thank you very much. Please vote yes.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Roblin, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Burley, how do you vote? Votes aye. Senate Bill 408A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 409, relating to placement of children.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 409A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Senate Bill 409A allows the court to direct the Department of Human Resources to place a child with parents, relatives, or another foster care provider. Studies show that children who are placed with relatives or persons with whom they have a close relationship adjust better than children placed with strangers. There was an administrative rule at the time we started this process that gave the Department of Human Resources more discretion on where to place the children with their parent or relative, and actually was in conflict with the statute. Senate Bill 409 clarifies that the court can direct placement. This is a good bill. It's part of the package. Please vote yes.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I will be brief. It just clarifies in the statute the ability of the department to place a child with a relative. Obviously, I've had some questions about this. This would only be when it's appropriate, when we know it's in the best interest of the safety, health, and welfare of the child. It isn't mandating we put them with a relative. It just makes it clear, giving the department the ability to place them with a relative, and frequently that is the best choice for the child. Good bill. I urge your vote. Thanks.
Further discussion? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, this is the reason, and I'm going to tell you why we need some law like this. In Southern Oregon, we had a family that lost their children due to drug use, which was fine. But unfortunately, Department of Human Services put that child in a foster care family and left the relationship of the family itself, which there was another family that was blood related to this child, did not place that child in that home. Now, 2 years down the road, the blood relatives wanted to adopt this child. Department of Human Services would not allow the blood relatives to see the child except quarterly, once every 3 months. So they end up going and were denied the ability to adopt their own relation, their own blood relation, because of their lack of ability to have a relationship with the child, which was caused by the Department of Human Services. Now, the real sad part about it is the blood relative family was a foster care family in the state of Oregon. who's going to pick up this mess, I don't know, because now it's going into litigation. But this is a fine example of the inequities and the inability of DHS to handle its own, because there is no bill. It's just a policy. We need to put this bill into place, and we need to go forward. We need to keep children with their blood relatives. I urge an aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you. I wanted to thank the carrier for Happy Valley for clarifying that indeed this gives the permission to be able to place with relatives, but does not always mandate that, and would also include, I know in the discussions with the advocates of this bill, recognizing that these appropriate placements are not necessarily blood relatives, but could be kin, those who have known children for a very long time. And I'm sure that we all recognize there are many ways to build families, that blood is not the only thing that ties us to our families. And I'm pleased that we recognize this, and that this wouldn't necessarily lead to a child being placed in Maryland because they're related to someone by blood, rather than someone that they attended church with that they had known their entire life. And that, of course, in a family where a child had been adopted, that would not undermine the integrity of that family simply because they were built by adoption rather than by blood. Families are built in a lot of ways, not just by blood. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
Just briefly, I'll give you a Representative Jerry Crummell closing. Good bill should pass.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Richardson, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Burley, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Lim, how do you vote? Votes aye. Senate Bill 409A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 410, relating to Sensitive Review Committee, convened by Director of Human Services.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 410A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. ORS 409-192 gives the right to a citizen to review the actions and conduct of the Department of Human Services to establish a review process. ORS 409-225, the confidentiality of welfare records provisions, contains an exemption from the confidentiality provisions for persons serving as a member of a sensitive review committee convened by the Director of Human Services when the purpose of the committee is to determine whether the department acted appropriately and to make recommendations to the department regarding policy and practice. The Department of Human Services has used this statutory authority to create sensitive review committees. However, this process is not directly set forth in statute, and nothing allows a legislature to formally call for a review. Senate Bill 410 sets forth a process and procedure for the Director of Human Resources to convene a sensitive review committee for the purpose of reviewing the actions and conduct of the department. Senate Bill 410 allows the President of the Senate or the Speaker of the House to request that the Director convene a sensitive review committee. This bill establishes that if the Director appoints a committee at the request of the Senate President or the Speaker of the House, the President and the Speaker shall appoint at least one member from the respective chambers and must make reasonable efforts to ensure balanced representation on the committee. Senate Bill 410 requires a Senate Review Committee impaneled at the request of the legislature to report back to the legislature no less than 180 days after the legislative request. Again, this is a good bill. I remind you that we may not always have a Dr. Goldberg who is willing to help us. The agency has had five directors in 5 years. Director Goldberg has tremendous, in my opinion, character, and I believe the man is moral, and he will always be there to help his agency and to help us, but we don't know how long he will be there as the director. So this puts something in place that you and I, when we have something come up, we can go to our speaker or the Senate president, if you're over there, and request this of the director of the agency.
Representative Schaffler.
Speaker, this is a good bill. This process should continue on. I want to join my friend from District 49 in thanking my friend from Southwest Oregon, because he really did put this all together, and he really did drive it home. And he made it very clear all through the process, we were not out for a pound of flesh. We were not looking for blame. We were looking for holes, inconsistencies, areas where we could improve the foster care, juvenile dependency process, and help caseworkers, citizen review boards, public defenders, district attorneys, everyone in the system, make it very clear what their job was, what their job description was, so that there's fairness. And we repeatedly, my friend from Southwest Oregon, repeatedly spoke to how we have to make sure justice is meted out when we're talking about the health, safety, and welfare of our children, especially our most vulnerable citizens, children find themselves in these situations. This bill will continue that process. Great idea. I urge your vote. Thanks.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
Just very, very briefly. As a result of, Madam Speaker, of this bill and the work that we did, Dr. Goldberg has pretty much instituted a policy where they're going to be doing quarterly reviews on their own. When they see something at some local level out here where you are, something shows up, they get some complaints, something doesn't appear to be right, they're going to be doing this on their own. So I think that's a good sign, but we still need this bill, so if we find something, we can also go to him. Thank you very much. Please vote for the bill.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. All members have voted. Senate Bill 410A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 412, relating to reports of child abuse.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 412A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Senate Bill 412 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee by unanimous vote. When a person under the age of 18 is living in a condition that endangers the welfare of the child, or among other reasons, the child has been abandoned, is being subjected to cruelty, depravity, or unexplained physical injuries, or is not being provided with the care and education the law requires, the state of Oregon will assume responsibility for the protection of the child. The child is placed in foster care. Nonetheless, the child is still under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. Children in foster care have been abused and do make complaints about abuse, which is important for the juvenile court to know. Those best suited to notify the court is the child's advocate, CASAS, his or her attorney, a court-appointed attorney, and again, the appointed special advocate, the CASAS, and the attorneys for the parents. Though foster parents must pass a background check, sometimes children are abused while in foster care. Senate Bill 412 adds another safeguard for children who are in protective custody of the department. Thank you, and please vote yes.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. This really makes sense. I don't know why we haven't been doing this all along, but I just want to point out, where are all the reporters and the cameras and the scribblers now when we have bills that are actually going to help this state, help the most vulnerable, and there's none in this room. I just wanted to editorialize there. I know it's not germane. Good bill. I urge your vote. Thanks.
Further discussion?
Yes, it is.
Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Patty Smith, how do you vote? Representative Patty Smith, off the floor. Senate Bill 412A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The chair requests unanimous consent that Senate Bill 950 be taken from today's calendar and placed in its proper place on the Wednesday, May 9th, 2007 calendar. The carrier is excused. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House? Other business of the Senate? Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Barnhart.
Madam Speaker, I ask unanimous consent to allow Representative Bruin to change his vote on House Bill 3086. It will not change the outcome.
Representative Barnhart requests unanimous consent that Representative Bruin be allowed to change his vote on House Bill 3086 on the third reading of House Bill 3086. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Representative Bruin, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Bruin votes aye. Further announcements? Remonstrances? Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 10 a.m., Wednesday, May 9th, 2007.
Madam Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 9, 2007.
Representative Jensen moves the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 9, 2007. Without objection, the House is adjourned.